Right. We're off. And this is a relatively important subject for radio frequency, matching networks. The idea behind matching networks is that you have a source of a source driver, a single generator, driving some other circuit, and it has a particular output impedance. And that output impedance, of course, is not 50 ohms. It's obviously going to usually be some resistance in series with some arbitrary reactance. And you want to couple that into a load, and we've already seen that you have to have a complex conjugate match. And there's more to it at radio frequency. That was the story at low frequencies. In addition to that, you have to worry about whether you're going to couple your network through a transmission line to a load, in which case you need two matching networks, as you'll see. Okay, in order to... there are two ways you can go about designing matching networks we're going to look at. And there are a special case of matching networks referred to as filters, which are in every way equivalent and usable as matching networks, except they're much more complicated. And this book by Bowick is the one that I'll be following in these lectures. And in this course, and has a very pragmatic introduction to filters and matching networks and the two ways of designing matching networks. So we'll have a broad look at how we treat those. They're differently treated in this course, filters and matching networks. We'll look at the definition of capital Q. Q, the quality factor, as it's called, is a very useful parameter, mathematical quantity, really, in radio circuits. And we'll look at a design of matching networks using Q. Right, so first of all, let's have to say what we're going to do. These frequency dependent four port networks or dispersive networks broadly come into two different categories. In the sense, they're not actually different, but they're the same thing and you can design them in the same way, but you often have an aim just to do a match, or you'll have an aim to have a particular tailored frequency response. Okay, and we have to, when we design either filters or matching networks, we have to design for power transfer as well as the characteristic impedance match. In this lecture, we'll look at just the matching networks, okay? And obviously, now you have to be a bit careful. There are some situations. For example, when you buy a radio frequency filter off the shelf, it'll be from 50 ohms to 50 ohms. That's all they build it for. And it'll have a particular frequency response, and those things are easy to design. However, usually when doing radio frequency design in your own right, with your own print circuit board, in your own little circuit, then what's going to concern you is what happens when you connect transistor amplifier stage 1 to transistor amplifier stage 2. And there you don't need a filter off the shelf for anything, right? So you may want a filter, but you wouldn't buy one, and you wouldn't be going from 50 ohms to 50 ohms. Instead, you'll have an appreciable reactance at both the output and the input of those amplifiers. And believe me, they're all over the place. They don't design 50 ohm transistors, okay? So those impedances can often be... for a FET power amplifier at VHF, for example, the input capacitance could be 100 picofarads. In other words, it almost swamps any signal that goes into it, shorts it out, and somehow you've got to make do, okay? And usually, of course, because they have this appreciable reactance, any design you do is only actually going to work at one frequency. So we'll be looking at how you might design these circuits to make them work at least broadly and approximately. But, of course, when you do the design, it'll only work at one frequency. And, of course, matching networks can be designed as filters. So a filter is a four-port network with it's basically a matching network, has a frequency response specifically tailored for a purpose. So you have types of filter. You can have a low, high-pass, stop-band, and band-pass filters. The main concerns with filters being their frequency response. But they could also match... we use the same way to handle stray impedances when doing a match with filters. Namely, if you're building a filter as a matching interface between two amplifier stages, then any output reactants and input reactants has to be absorbed into the filter somehow by simply putting it in parallel with another reactants in that filter. All right, and well, I don't know how best to handle this. I don't know how many of you ever, because you would have seen this in the references now, but this is the book. I don't think it's published anymore. So I've got to figure out how the best way is for me to get sections of it for you to read. In the past, I've just photocopied them and handed them out. I suppose that's still all right, isn't it? Yeah. All right, I'll do that. All right, now let's have a look at what happens in matching. In this lecture, we're going to discuss, the most general type of matching network. And if it's true that you could go to, so this book here has quite a detailed section on filters, designing all the different types of filters, such as Chebyshev different frequency responses. And these frequency designs are all done by tables, and so they're really quite boring and straightforward to do. Filter design. In fact, it even comes before impedance matching in this book, which is interesting. And so, just to show you what the ticket looks like. Yes, okay, so here are different examples of transfer functions of filters. You can see that they have these are low-pass filters, and some of them have pretty weird-looking responses. And the design that one undergoes when doing a filter is about tailoring that response. So you want some frequency response from a filter. On the other hand, when we look at matching networks, the algebraic process you go through for a filter is more complex than what I'm about to do for matching networks. But matching networks, on the other hand, the emphasis is on making that power transfer one as high as possible. And at the same time, there's a little bit of latitude for changing the for adjusting the frequency response, so you can either make it a narrow band match or a broad band match, and then that's about all the choices that you have. All right, so let's look at this exercise. We want to try and match RS to RL, and these resistances are not necessarily the same, obviously. This is a very crude picture that I've got here. It doesn't actually represent any matching network that we have, although it is a practical type if RL is small and RS is larger than RL. Even if RS is 50 ohms and RL is 1 ohm, this kind of matching network will work just about over the whole frequency range, radio frequency range. And just to give it, I don't know, this is probably a... it's probably a bit tough for some of you to see what's going to happen here. But let's imagine that we start by adjusting this capacitor to tune that L. Who knows what's going to happen there? Right. Remember that if I plot the impedance, the real and the imaginary parts of the impedance of a parallel matching network, a parallel tank circuit like that LC, then we get a resistance which increases like that, and a reactant. Now at low frequencies, it's mainly inductive. And then at higher frequencies, above the resonant frequency, it becomes capacitive. Okay, you've all seen that before. And you may know by now too that this resistance here reaches a peak value omega squared L squared plus R squared over R. So if R is small and L is large enough, then it's quite possible that this could be greater than RS. And this, by the way, is RL, That's RL. And that's at resonance. At resonance, there is no reactance, okay? Generally speaking, it's going to be impossible to design that circuit so that at resonance, that omega squared L squared plus R squared over RS is exactly equal to, over RL is exactly equal to RS. So who can see what we're going to do? We've also got another capacitor there to play with, C prime. What are we going to do? What are we going to do here? Can you see what's happening? Supposing, because we've assumed here that little RL is small, then this point here might be bigger than RS, so RS is down here, okay? And so in order to make this parallel network equal to RS, obviously we have to be off resonance. And if we're off resonance, then we have an inductive part. Well, we could have also worked with the capacitive part, but at the moment, in this example, it's an inductive residual reactance, which I've represented by L res, And you can see that if we tune C to L res, then finally we can make RS equal RS. And we have a match, a perfect match. Everyone understand that idea?
Okay. All right, now that's the simple introduction. However, that methodology I've just described to you there is a bit hit and miss. In actual fact, matching networks are much easier to design than that. Yes.
So what happens to the capacitor
in parallel? Which one in parallel? This, no, the one over in that, sorry, go back to here. This one over here, well, where to go, are you saying?
Yeah, you said that you tuned the capacitors.
Oh, well, yes. Well, what's the impedance of the tank circuit there is J omega L plus RL over 1 minus omega squared R plus J omega L CRL, isn't it? That's what the parallel impedance of this thing is, right? And if you plot it out, it looks like this. So I jump straight to here. This C is actually what's resonating with the L. Yeah, okay? All right.
Yeah, okay, in so many ways, that's actually a complicated example. But here we have, in order to discuss matching networks properly, we have to understand Q.
Now, I find Q is the most difficult concept I ever had to understand in RF, and I think the problem with it is because of its appearance in physics. So anyone who's doing physics is probably disadvantaged by Q. But has anyone heard of Q before? Capital Q. Who knows what I'm on about, this quality factor already? No, nobody. Good, a few blank faces. Well, that's a good sign. Because you probably don't want to let your intuition get too much in the way here, okay? Right, what is it? Well, this is what a physicist would tell you it is. It's the radiant frequency multiplied with the ratio of electromagnetic energy stored to power dissipated in a reactor. Okay? It's Q is just a... It's called quality factor, I suppose you could say it stands for. However, it represents... It's a way of measuring... Remember what we talked about, loss tangent in dielectrics? Well, Q is the incarnation of loss tangent when you talk about a component. Like you've got an L or a C in your hand, what's its Q? And it's a function of frequency, obviously. And so there's the picture of it. Now, yeah, I mean, that's what it's defined to be. How you measure it's another thing, and what meaning it has is yet another still. For lossless reactants, Q is infinite. And it's a really good quality, infinite quality, right? But that's because this R is zero, as we'll see in a moment. And physically, you can understand that by the fact that a capacitor can store energy and dissipate no power whatsoever. And so a capacitor, that a DC, a capacitor which... a DCQ doesn't mean anything because this multiplying factor of omega would be zero. But a DC, if you had a lossless capacitor, the power loss would really be zero. No leakage, right? Inductors, they're another site. I mean, R and L's here, for example. An L can have an R for many reasons. We've already spoken about ohmic losses, but we also know that they can radiate. L's are little antennas waiting to happen, and so they can also be lossy. All right, so here's a bit of the mathematics. We want to end up with a formula for Q, obviously, given that we have a reactants, and the only two reactants as we know about are inductors and capacitors. So there's the definitions of power loss. Well, those should be familiar to you. If RL is the series resistance with the inductor, then I squared RL over 2 gives you the power loss. That factor of 2 depends on whether obviously I'm thinking of I being peak current here, not RMS current, that's all right. And then the energy of an inductor and a capacitor is given respectively by a half Li squared, where I is, again, the peak current. So the energy in an inductor changes with time as it oscillates, okay? But we're talking about the peak energy here. And the energy of a capacitor is a half CV squared, and you can replace that by the current through the capacitor by dividing by its reactants, and Q is just omega times the ratio. So for an inductor, we have this formula, which may be familiar to some of you, and for a capacitor, we have that formula. And if you know that, remember that the reactance of the capacitor is 1 over omega C, and the reactance of an inductor is omega L, then clearly we've just derived the same formula. In other words, Q is, for when one puts the resistance in series with the reactance, then Q is X over R.
Okay? All right. Now, the formula for Q, now this is an important point. About as many times as you want to put the resistance in series with the reactants, you'll also want to have exactly the same numerical value, but with the resistance in parallel with the reactants at one frequency only, okay? And if you do that, you can easily show, if we call this the series arrangement here, then the same Q is actually given by RP over XP, so actually PP series. So this is a series representation of a dissipative reactance, and this is simply its parallel representation, and they're both equivalent, and the Q in either case is just given by the reciprocal there. So here's an example for an inductor. The current source is jolly irrelevant in this diagram, but anyway, L over those X's are not the same, by the way, so I've made a mistake. That's XS on RS, okay, and RP on XP. All right. Let's just scratch the surface of Q a little bit more. What are ways of measuring Q? Okay, there are circuit techniques for measuring Q. They're actually not of any interest in matching, by the way, but since I've gone this far with Q, I may as well tell you a little bit about the woes of a physicist, if you like. Place the high Q component in parallel and series and measure the resonance curve. That should be a high Q component or a very efficient component. Usually it's a capacitor. It's easy to make lossless capacitors and inductors, okay? Q determines how much oscillating radio frequency energy per unit power consumption can be supported by a passive device in isolation. So you have to be careful not to load Q. So here are typical examples of ways you would measure Q, and you have to be careful not to load this circuit. Here, the device under test is this reactance, this L and this R, and we've put a super duper capacitor across it, and they really do exist, okay? Capacitors with Qs of 1,000. So when you're trying to measure a Q of 10 in your inductor here, then that capacitor is not going to affect the impedance you measure, because the RP across that capacitor loading there is very large. Maybe 10K is not out of the question for some really good capacitors at radio frequency. On the other hand, you have to feed it from a current source if you're going to do that. Why is that? Anyone see? What's the output impedance of a current source? Luke, what's the output impedance of a current source? What is a current source?
Zero.
No. Exact opposite of the right answer. What's the opposite of zero? What's the natural enemy of zero? It's infinite, right? A current source is a 1 amp current source aims 1 amp at what's ever in its path. Okay? If you try to change that current, it won't change. And the only way to change the current is by varying the resistance in the circuit. That's the only knob you've got to twiddle, because you're in a passive circuit, okay? You never change that current. Therefore, that current is acting like an infinite voltage in series with an infinite resistance. In other words, treating the circuit like it's a little pipsqueak thing, right, and shooting an ant into it. The output impedance of a current source is infinite, yes.
So if you had infinite,
yes, you do. That's what I just said. It's the limit of a voltage source of infinite value aimed at your circuit. So it's easy to understand what a current source is. A current source is a voltage of 10 to the 23 in series with a resistance of 10 to the 23 ohms. Okay? What's the current coming out of that, Wasanta? 1 amp, yeah. And what's going to change that current of 1 amp? A resistance of about 10 to the 23 ohms. Forget about it. Okay? And therefore, forget about trying to understand the meaning of the power dissipated in that resistor, because it has no physical meaning whatsoever. All right? Current sources have infinite impedance. Oh, what about a voltage source? What impedance does it have? Zero, yeah, it has zero. It's just a volt.
But it's every bit as wild and woolly as a current source, right? Because what's the current flowing there? That's a voltage source of 1 volt. Current into a what's the current into a short circuit?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. Just as mad as this is also mad, right? This is the 240 volt mains, right? 240 volts, no output resistance to slow it down. All right, so that means that the way you measure Q here is you feed this parallel circuit. You can do it either way by a current source because it has infinite impedance, so it's not going to load the tank either, okay? Or on the other hand, you can put the capacitor in series with that L and then feed it by a voltage source. Both of those situations are going to lead to a point where this resistor is going to be completely determined by the current that flows from that source. And now the physicist's picture of Q is typically a resonant cavity where you have a metal box and you set up a standing wave inside that metal box, and the metal box is made of some highly conducting material in their imaginations, right? And so one way to feed it is a voltage-driven feed where the impedance there is high, okay? And that corresponds to this circuit, even though that's a current source and that's voltage-driven. And the other way to feed it is an inductive coupling, a current-driven cavity in which you have a loop there and you provide a voltage. Either way, you can excite this resonance and you can measure the impedance, if you like, of the cavity, and that gives you a way of measuring Q. So let's have a look at that in more detail. What is Q if you can do all that? Well, you measure the resistance of the resonance curve, the resistance that you would measure into such a circuit, and the Q is simply given by the ratio of the frequency at which the resonance occurs. That's the center frequency divided by the half power frequencies, the 3 dB frequencies, F2 minus F1. You can try that out in MATLAB if you like. So they're the half power points. That's important. What does that mean? It means that you've got to calculate the power dissipated in this circuit by this current source. So if you're off at resonance, remember this has a very large resistance, but this is a current source and it can feed that large resistance. Therefore, the power goes up in a direct proportion to that parallel resistance of the resonance circuit. Okay, so that's how you do it. And now you measure that power as a function of frequency, there's Q. And you can see now where the physicist's idea about Q comes in here. Q means a sharp curve. High Q means sharp, right? If this is a Q of 10,000, then that's 1 megahertz, then this is 100 hertz across here. That's a big change in a short range of frequency. All right, here's another one that I find kind of cute. My PhD supervisor came up with this idea. If you see a resonant cavity decaying in time on an oscilloscope, right, and you can count the number of oscillations, so you just turn up the time base, so you see the number of oscillations, you usually have an 8-bit oscilloscope, something not very much, fill it so that the peak fits the screen, the Q is equal to the number of cycle peaks that you can count on it. So that would have a Q of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, about 15. Right, and how do you produce that curve? Well, actually it's not a very useful thing in radio, as it turns out, but when you're exciting this curve, of course you're doing it CW, you're driving this current continuously. But if you look at the cavity here, for example, or this resonant circuit, supposing then you drive this to resonance and then you turn the current source off, the current flowing in that resonant circuit doesn't go away immediately. It rings down as it decays. It's got energy stored in it. And the definition of Q is the ratio of the energy stored to the power lost per cycle. And so Q measures how quickly this goes down. The lower is Q, the faster it goes down. The higher is Q, then the amount of power lost per cycle is tiny. And so this ring lasts forever. It's called ringing. Well, that's a cute way of measuring Q. It's not a very accurate way, but there you go. All right, so here's why we like Q. I don't know what's happened here. I hope I've got the magic
screensaver. Seems to be going.
All right. Now, rightio, we're going to use a matching network. We're going to, in this lecture, we're just going to look at making ZL equal to ZS star. Right, now, there are two types of matching network we're going to consider. The basic component of a matching network, which does everything we need just about, is an L network. Pi and T networks give us a bit more flexibility. Matching networks consist entirely of reactances. Okay, that's important because you could never, ever get power transfer of 100 from maximum power transfer from a source to a load if the matching network gobbles up the power on the way through or pays any kind of import tax. So how to deal with reactive sources? Well, often these sources that we're going to be matching to loads have reactants of their own, in their own right. The typical procedure for handling that is to absorb any reactants they have into the matching network when you do the analysis, or you can resonate. If it's too large to absorb, you can resonate it out. However, these techniques really just transfer the matching situation into one where we're matching a resistor to a resistor. All right, and the other thing that you should never forget is if you're matching a source to a load and you've got a transmission line in between, a 50-ohm line, then you really have two matching problems to do. One from the source to the transmission line to make the characteristic impedance match, and another one out of the transmission line into the load, okay? Well, everyone following so far? Right. All right, there they are. This is the basic L matching network. There are two different types. We're matching a source to a load, and you can see you can either have a reactance in series and parallel like that, or reversed. Okay? Now, how do we choose which one we should use? It turns out that's straightforward. If the source resistance, okay, is less than the load resistance. Now, by the load resistance, by the way, that is the effective parallel resistance of this load, okay? So, if we're talking about a particular source with a resistance here, and supposing it has some inductance in series with it, whereas the load is, say, capacitive, and we want to match those two to each other, so that's ZS and that's Z load, then the resistance, R load, we're talking about is in fact the parallel resistance of that ZL, okay? Whereas the RS we're talking about is the series resistance, and that's in the case where we're considering which of these networks to use, okay? So if RS is less than ZL, righto, then we choose the shunt arrangement at the load. So we choose this one, this circuit, for example, if the parallel resistance of ZL is greater than RS, okay? And vice versa, if the parallel resistance of ZS is greater than ZL, then we choose this. It should be pretty obvious that the reason for doing that is that if the parallel resistance of ZL is greater than than the series resistance of RS, then we're going to have to divide its magnitude down in order to do a match, because we want the resistance seen on either side of this green line to be equal to the resistance from both the source and load direction, okay? That was part of the condition. The condition for a match is that the complex conjugates of the load impedance equal that of the source impedance, as seen by the source, okay? So we put this network in between to make it apparent to the source that it's looking at a resistor of its own value, same value as the source, and a reactance which is opposite in sign. Okay. All right, now this is the crucial point. Since the impedances seen in either direction through that green line, okay, must be complex conjugates of each other. Now that's an interesting thing. Okay, I've got this. I'm about to answer my question, what about the blue lines here? But this guy here, if this is a matching network, then this guy here must see ZS star when looking this way. This guy here must see ZL star when looking this way. But that's at the blue lines. But at the green lines, what happens? Well, it's also matched because we've got maximum power transfer. So this guy looking back this way must see, say if it sees one impedance, then looking this way it must see the complex conjugate of that impedance. And what's the consequence of that? Well, the consequence for Q is that if you're looking at, if you're in a situation where that's Z and that's Z star, then when looking in either of those directions, the real parts here are the same. So if this is a series arrangement, then X over R at the source equals Q must equal XL over RL at the load. So the Qs of these components, the purple one and the black one here and the green one and the black one there, must be the same. And that's how you do the match. Okay? Alright. Alright, if that's the case, then let's just draw this out so we see it clearly.
I don't have a picture there, do I?
Oh, I do. Right, yes, so you're right. This, have a look at that, this. Okay, now here we're saying, let's say we're in a situation where RL is larger than RS, okay? This is the situation, the first case up there. Then in that case, we're obliged to put our matching reactants across RL, okay? In order to divide it down. And our, in the L network, the excess then becomes in series with RS. All right, if that's the case, then the Q is equal to XS on RS, okay? And it's also equal to RL on XL. Remember that for parallel representation of a reactance with its dissipating R across the reactance, the Q is given by RL over XL, okay? Now, in the converse situation where RS is greater than RL, then we have these two in parallel, so RS on XS would be the Q. So, but these are two different situations, okay? This one here with RL greater than RS, and this one here with RS greater than RL. And similarly, XL over RL gives you the Q of the load network. All right? So you can sort of get the picture as we go along what we're trying to do with this network. First of all, you'll notice that I'm considering only RS and RL. I'm not considering here the reactances in the source and load impedance, right? And that's because you can forget about them. We'll just think about what we'll do with them later by adjusting the overall reactants through excess and XL, either to resonate or to absorb those stray reactances belonging to the source and the load back into the matching components, okay? All right. Oh, now. All right. Suppose then we have a matching network. You can see that if RL and RS are related, these formulae up here give you the relationship between RL and RS, okay? So you know what RL and RS are, and what you need to do now is to calculate what the Q is. The Q is going to be the same in the input and output circuit for a match, for the reasons I just told you. In other words, the Q of this component and the Q of this one are exactly the same, okay? In addition to that, we choose XS and XL so that the reactances have opposite sign. And if we do that, then we have a match. And you can show that RL over RS is given by 1 plus Q squared in the situation. I mean, obviously, these formulae are exactly the same, except that this is the case where RL is in shunt and RS is in series. In other words, RL is greater than RS, and here where RS is greater than RL. And you can then solve for the Q from these formulae. And this is the first step in the matching process in reality, okay? By having the input and the output circuit have the same Q, we're going to have a match. That's all it is. So what is that Q? That Q has to be equal to RL over RS minus 1 in the case where RL is greater than RS. And you can see immediately that there's only one choice you can make here because you can never have a Q that's an imaginary number.
So RL must be greater than RS, and this is the case where RS is greater than RL, so corresponding to these figures. Okay. Yes. The reason for this formula, I don't think I'll have time to derive it here, is because we're using the series and the parallel definitions of Q. Okay?
All right. So here's a summary of L networks. You already know now all you need to know about them.
The first step is to place the shunt of the L network across the highest resistance and the series of the L in series with the lowest resistance of the two components you have to match. Compute the Q from that formula I gave you. Then use Q to find. Now, if because you know RS and RL, what you don't have, of course, are XS and XL. They're the unknowns in the problem, because there was no need. Neither of the source nor the load actually had a reactive part necessarily. Okay, XS and XL are the matching network that we're trying to solve for. So we find those from the Q using these formulae up the top here. Okay. So, using these formulas would be the way to do it. Okay. And then, all right, the next thing you have to do is you have to choose, these are just reactances, you have to choose their signs opposite. And you can see that's not unique. In other words, you could have an inductor, there are two solutions, one with the capacitor and one with an inductor and vice versa in the matching network. So, suppose we're in the case here. This could be an inductor and that a capacitor and vice versa. It's not unique, and that's typical of matching networks. Obtaining a match is not the only criterion in the problem. So if you want to, for example, have a DC blocking capacitor here because there's a DC power supply, you'd need to make that one the capacitor. Criteria like that, for example, you would use. The next step, and the last step, is that if it turned out that those resistors, RS and RL, actually were impedances and had a reactive part, then you'll have to juggle those reactances around so that they're combined into the reactances of the matching network that you've solved for. Okay? All right. So we've just introduced the simplest matching network, and everything in that is all you ever have to know about matching networks. Okay? But there are some problems with matching networks of this type. First of all, Q arose from the calculation, and that's a terrible shame. It means that you weren't allowed to specify Q. Now, Q is a parameter that you'd like to keep free, because remember, it determines how sharp that resonance is. And over here, when we're doing our tuning of our resonance circuits, one can imagine, right, that this circuit that we've got here is in actual fact a resonant circuit based on its Q, okay? And we go back here and one was it all? This thing here is going to describe the frequency response of this circuit. What happens if we want to make that frequency response very narrow? Then we need a very high Q. The problem is that in an L network, it tells you what the Q has to be. And so it could be anything, and the examples, even for matching very different impedances, turns out to be like a Q of 3. Now, Q of 3 is not a particularly sharp resonance, okay? If you look back at this picture again, a Q of 3 means that the bandwidth is one-third of the centre frequency. So it's clearly a very broad resonance. All right. The solution, then, is a T and pi network. So we go one step more complicated, and these allow us to choose Q. Right. There's a problem with this, and you can think about it, and that is that the Q is always going to be higher than the L network would have given, because the L network Q depended upon the ratio of the resistance here, okay? And I'll show you in a minute that when we analyse this network, which is really two back-to-back L networks, okay, this is the way you analyse these. You do them as back-to-back L networks. You split that one down the middle, and you have a virtual resistance to ground, and you match on either side of that virtual resistance. In this case, you split this guy into two parallel components, and you match back-to-back. Both the pi and the T network allow you to have Qs that are much higher than the Q of the L networks. That would, in other words, the Q as determined by the ratios of the real parts of ZL and ZS. Okay, and so sometimes more than often than not, that's what you want, because now you've got some filtering going on. You've got a bandpass filter. At the end of the lecture, I'll show you what you do if you want to go even lower than an L network. All right, so how to analyse these? Well, you probably haven't understood how to analyse L networks quite yet, but I can at least show you how this is just the same process. Well, the first thing we do is we choose Q, and you're allowed to choose Q to be anything larger than the minimum Q. As you'll see in a minute, there's a constraint on it. Unfortunately, this circuit looks like it has two Qs, which it does during the analysis, okay? Because there's a right-hand circuit and there's a left-hand circuit. Righto, and now this resistor here that I've put in, this is a resistor, and as in the case of the L circuit, we only analyse, we forget about the reactants that this may have, okay? Now in the case of this is a pi network, what I've split down the middle. In other words, it's this top one. I've split the excess down the centre there. So we're going to have to re-express this as an impedance in parallel with that if we're going to absorb it later on. But let's suppose this is a resistor, and this is a resistor to start with. And we have this virtual resistor which never existed before, and we've split this up into two series, XS1 and XS2. XS1 plus XS2 must be XS. In other words, it's this guy here. Okay. So what we've got is our magic green dotted line again, and the condition for a match is obviously going to be, well, if we arrange it so that this resistor here is matched to ZL, because we choose these components so that this here sees its own value when it looks into the matching network without any reactive component. And we do the reverse. We look back with this guy here seeing R when looking back to ZS. Then when we join the two circuits together and get rid of R, then we have a match. Either way, do you understand the philosophy behind that? It's all to do with thinking about complex conjugates. You have to have the complex conjugates matching, and you have to have the resistances equal in order to get a power match. Okay. All right. The T network is similar. In fact, you can see it's exactly the same now, except that I've got these pointing around the other way. All right. And then finally, so I won't go into any of the details there. So once again, of course, we're going to go through this process back here. We're going to say, well, if RL is greater than RS, where RL, say, if we're on the right-hand side of this circuit, let's go down to this guy here. Right, there's RL there, and we want to find the virtual resistance there. Then the ratio of RL to the virtual resistance, which is now this RS, is given by 1 plus Q squared. But now we're free to choose what Q is, because we don't know what RS is. Yes. It can't be lower than the L network. It can't be lower than the maximum value of the individual. Yes. Okay. Why is that the case? Because have a look at the pi network and the T network. They both have a. All right. In this case here, let's suppose that's RL, then the Q is going to be given by RL on RS. I call it RV. It's the virtual resistance here, okay? Similarly, that's one Q. And the other Q will be given by now RV, because this, if you look at the construction of this, when we put the virtual resistance in here, the dividers
on this are, whether we like it or not, both in parallel with the source and the load. Right, so that means that RV has to be smaller than both RS and RV. Whereas if we'd done this design with an L network, then Q would have been RL on RS. Okay? Therefore, RV is less than both of these. If it's less than both of these, then the one of these Qs is much bigger than this one. Okay? And it is the dominant Q which dominates this circuit. So I haven't said that so far. It's an empirical fact. We can. I'll try and do some simulations and show you this soon, maybe this afternoon. So this RV can be as tiny as you like for the pi network. If you use the T network, it's the reverse situation, of course, because now, when you split these two guys in half, where do I have that? Here. Then the RVs, in this case now, have to be both greater than ZL and RL and RS, right? So now, these... the Q in this particular case is also going to be greater. Okay? Now, all right. Now that you've asked that question, I suppose I should go to the last view graph. There's a circuit you use if you want Q to be lower than the match. It's not a T or a pi. It's something else. And now you can see what happens here is that this RV... If you split this off, so that goes to the left, and we split this down here actually, then RV is less than RS in that situation. It's acting like the pi. So Q in this case, Q1 would be RS on RV. These formulas I've got here are wrong. Sorry, it's obviously that minus one. So Q1 is RS, the square root of RS on RV minus 1, and Q2, now in Q2 we split this guy, so now it's the other way around, RV on RL minus 1, okay? Now if I pick RV there's a trick to this. If we make these Q's equal, then RL times RS, then RV is given by the square root of RL times RS, okay? And what is that Q? Well, it's Q is going to be given by the square root of RV. It's the square root of RS on RL. Yep. Minus 1. Okay? And that Q is obviously less than that of the L network because of that extra square root factor there. Right. That was improvised. Everyone's right. It says in Boeck's book, Boeck doesn't prove anything, right? He states that if you want to achieve the lowest Q possible, you need to take the geometric mean of RL and RS via RV in this circuit. Okay. So now you know how to do it. I think what we need now is practice to do these, right? And these are the main formulae up here. The first thing we're going to do in the tutorial today is we'll derive these formulae and start working a few examples, unless, of course, you've got issues with prior stuff in the course. Because this actually looks like a headache of a lecture. This is a sort of a headache to give it, actually. But this procedure is very simple. It's surprising how quick this is. Even banging around in Solve is going to take a lot longer than just providing a simple formalism, right? And then after that, you can go and use Solve and model the thing, okay, if you want to. However, when you do filters in Boeck, using those filter tables, when you're trying to do that's even more of a headache than this. But at least you get tailored frequency response when you do that, whereas this technique, picking Q, is as good as it gets. Okay? Right. Any further questions?
Yeah.